Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We have just launched a wonderful new way to sustain the TV production of Uprising. The funds that our supporters helped raise through Indiegogo last April to launch this TV version of Uprising that you're now watching were put to wonderful use, purchasing the camera equipment and the lights, plus getting the staff and training that we needed for the first year of operations. Now, of course, that was last April, so the money is running out. And to keep Uprising's TV production fully funded and viable, we've just launched a subscription-based online-only YouTube channel. Starting immediately, all of Uprising's TV shows are available exclusively on youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali, even before the show airs on Free Speech TV. And best of all, there's never any pledge drives or advertising. So you can subscribe right now at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Now, yes, you do have to pay for access to the channel, and we know that there's so much free content out there that you might wonder why you're being asked to subscribe, but you're a fan of Uprising, and we hope you will appreciate having all of the groundbreaking and thought-provoking coverage that we do regularly of the news in one place. We promise you it's going to be worth it. The subscription will cost only $4.99 a month, $4.99 a month for all our full daily shows with no ads or no fundraising drives. And best of all, the first 2 weeks are free, so you can always change your mind. There'll still be plenty of free content on our YouTube channel daily, including our popular news flash segments and short excerpts of all our interviews. But to access the full show, you'll need to be a paid subscriber. $4.99 a month is not very much if you think about all the incredible content that you'll get every day. So I really hope you will become a paid subscriber. Again, that's at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Thank you so much. And on to our next story. When President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act into law on July 2, 1964, among the hand-picked live audience witnessing his signature was a woman who had often asked the hardest questions in the White House. Ethel Payne, who was one of the first black women to receive White House press credentials, has come to be known as the First Lady of the Black Press. Writing for one of the most important black newspapers in the nation, the Chicago Defender, Payne was on the front lines of the civil rights movement and broke race and gender barriers in journalism. Yet her name is still little known. Now, a sweeping biography of Ethel Payne details the arc of an extraordinary life. Joining us shortly will be James Morris McGrath. He is an author, columnist, and radio host, and his books include Pulitzer, A Life in Politics, Print, and Power, as well as The Rose Man of Sing Sing, a true tale of life, murder, and redemption in the age of yellow journalism. His latest book is called Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press.
Glad to be with you this morning.
So first, what about Ethel Payne's childhood and background prepared her for her career? You write about a particularly frightening experience during her childhood sparked by the killing of a young black boy.
Childhood was very important. You know, as you know, the book portrays her rise from the south side of Chicago to becoming one of the most significant reporters in the civil rights beat in the 1950s and 60s, working for an African-American newspaper. She grew up in a part of South Side where, like many African Americans, she felt the hatred of whites in 1919. It was a very famous summer, nicknamed the Red Summer. Particularly what happened in Chicago at that point is several African American children went swimming on a beach in a hot summer day. And Chicago was segregated, and the beaches were segregated. There was a white beach and a black beach. And these kids on their raft drifted into the area where whites bathed. One intolerant man threw stones at them, hit one of the children on the head, and he fell into the water and drowned. When they brought his body to the shore, it was a very volatile situation. They had one dead black child on the beach, these two terrified black children, and a mob got together, and blacks came from the northern beach down, and some violence ensued, and this opened up a floodgate of violence against African Americans in Chicago for a period of several days, where Irish and white gangs went into black neighborhoods and shot and pillaged. And so for her as a young child, she felt immediately what can happen when white hatred is unleashed on African Americans.
Right. So, James, what sort of access to education did the young Ethel Payne then have? Growing up, she sees that her sort of social education is the sort that you've just described, but then the formal education that she has access to, and any kind of aspirations. And we can, by the way, see you on video. We've got your video feed up as we have your phone.
No, link to the host that we've got a phone line. I'm glad you warned me that you could see me.
So, James, so in terms of the sort of formal education that she might have had access to, and also her aspirations for writing and journalism, did that start pretty early in her life?
It started very early. She was very fortunate in one respect. Northern cities like Chicago were deeply segregated when she was born in 1911, segregated by custom, not by law. So if you were an African-American family like her parents looking for housing, the realtors would only let you look in certain parts of town. So, but instead of living in the all-black South Side, she lived in a part of South Side, West Englewood, where her neighborhood, while being all African-American, was surrounded by white neighborhoods. She described it as growing up on an island surrounded by a sea of whiteness. This was very important in her upbringing because, as a result, she went to white schools because they were all within walking distance. She went to the white public library, which was better than the public library serving the African-American population. It was hard. I mean, she describes that when she used to walk to high school, kids would throw stones at her and taunt her. But the key to this is that she got a better education than another child growing up in a different part of Southside Chicago. She also became, and I can't find a better word to describe it, but bicultural, in the sense that functioning in a mostly white high school, mostly white elementary school, she became used to functioning in the white world as well as in her own world. And we forget how important this is. I, as a white person growing up in the United States, was always afforded the luxury of remaining in my homogeneous community. I was not forced to have to function in another community. Whereas African Americans didn't have that choice. If they wanted to succeed in the economy, they would have to enter into the white mainstream world. Well, Ethel Payne became very well equipped to be able to function in that world, in part for having attended these all-white, well, I shouldn't say all-white, but mostly white high schools, which when she became a reporter and came to Washington in the 1950s, entered a lily white press corps, dealt with a universally white political leadership, she was well equipped to be bicultural and function in both worlds.
So, James, let's talk about the black press, where she got her major start and spent much of her career thriving. Before she even entered this world, how important was the black press, even in the years before the civil rights movement, as an institution within the black community, a way for the black community to stay in touch with the things that were happening, the horrific, you know, Jim Crow racism, lynchings, etc., that plagued this country? The black press, was it the only sort of institution really truly reporting on it?
In a way, it was. The black press dates back to 1827.
Wow.
But in the 20th century, it became a really important component of the civil rights movement, unappreciated by the white community. Because segregation was so strong in our society, whites didn't see the Chicago Defender or the Pittsburgh Courier on their newsstand. They had no exposure to this vibrant press that was functioning invisibly to them. And it has a very logical basis. In Chicago and Detroit and other cities in the North where African Americans migrated in waves, which is beautifully portrayed in Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns, they were still excluded from the economy of Chicago or the economy of these other cities. So they created their own world. In Southside Chicago, nicknamed Bronzeville, they created their own banks, their own cosmetic companies, their own taxi companies, their own funeral companies, and their own newspapers. And newspapers had a good economic basis because the stuff you and I expect from the media is sometimes the smaller things. We expect to see our children's graduations mentioned in the paper, wedding announcements, death notices, obituaries, what's playing in the theater. Well, newspapers like the Chicago Tribune had no interest in covering the African-American community. The only time an African-American would appear in the Chicago paper would be in connection to a crime, and often in a derogatory fashion. So a newspaper like the Chicago Defender had an economic basis in writing about their community.
So,
they grew from that to do other things. Please.
Right. This was the newspaper that hired Ethel Payne. She didn't have journalism experience or background, formally, that is, but they saw the importance of her work. They hired her. And this is one of the most important black newspapers in the country, still, I understand, operating today. And I understand she didn't obviously just break race barriers later in her career when she became the first person to, or one of the first few women, black women, to get White House press credentials. But didn't she also break, in many ways, gender barriers in journalism?
Gender was always an issue. In the white world of journalism at that point, the women who functioned often had to fight hard to get off the church beat, the social beat, and cover what you and I as journalists might call the hard news. So she had that as a strike against her. A woman in journalism at that period was a very hard road to go. But she had two strikes. She was also black. And so when she comes to Washington, D.C. as the Capitol correspondent for the Chicago Defender, and we should point out to listeners, Chicago Defender is not merely a Chicago newspaper any more than, say, the New York Times is merely a New York newspaper. This was a nationally circulated newspaper of significance. So here she is. There are two other African Americans in the White House press corps when she arrives in 1953. So to stand up and ask the white president a question, she was very conscious of the fact that she was black and a woman in a world that was, you know, virtually all male and all white. Mm. And she always had the courage and, frankly, self-described nerve to do this. And a lot of that nerve comes from the fact that she started being a reporter at age 40 after 20 years of being told no in every career option she took. Mm. She never let a door that was closed in her face stop her. So, you know, coming to journalism later in life gave her a depth of experience and a kind of nerve that allowed her to stand up. I mean, one of the things that was hard in portraying in this book, and your listeners, depending on their age, may not know this, but merely being a black reporter in Washington, which was a deeply segregated city in the 1950s, there were white senators who would turn the other way if you came down the hall to ask a question, and no one thought anything of this. The racism and segregation was so deeply ingrained. So you can imagine the kind of courage that she had to take up to do this kind of reporting.
Now, and I want to ask you about her confrontation of certain presidents, as, you know, journalists of courage should be doing. But before we even get there, let's talk about the relationship between Ethel Payne and the civil rights movement. Today, mainstream media outlets make much of a claim of objectivity, but here was Ethel Payne reporting on issues that she saw unfolding in the civil rights movement that deeply affected her, obviously personally and her community. But she naturally became an ally of the civil rights movement and was viewed, as such. But at that time, was she viewed as being too close to an issue that she was reporting on? Or is that sort of more modern-day sentiment?
I think that a criticism of her would, in some ways, depend on one's skin color back then. When Ethel Payne would get up every morning in Washington, D.C., the mere act of trying to get from her apartment to the White House to speak to the president was a challenge because Washington was a segregated city. Getting a cab could be a challenge. What restaurants she could go into was a challenge. So Payne learned very early on by her own reflections that she was as much part of the story. In a sense, she uses the word part of the problem, that she couldn't divorce herself and her pursuit of her journalism from that. So she abandoned the classic tenets of objectivity and replaced them with a very self-conscious form of fairness, which is what guided her journalism. I mean, she wrote about rabid segregationists in the Senate. She wrote about LBJ and John F. Kennedy when they were trying to gut the 1957 Civil Rights Bill. And these were things that affected her deeply because if the legislation passed, her life would be different the next day. And yet her coverage was extremely fair. She let them speak. She didn't accuse them of things. She didn't use the vitriolic kind of words that you see on Fox today. In a sense, she let them hang by their own words, and which is a much more clever form of journalism than just filling her copy with, hard adjectives about people.
And now let's talk about the way in which she did play a role in the White House, the sort of hard-hitting role that she played. You write in your book about her confrontation of President Eisenhower, and that sort of courage reminds me a little bit of the late, great Helen Thomas.
Very, very similar. People have often compared her to Helen Thomas, or Helen Thomas really, in a sense, came after her, but the style is similar. it's not the confrontation that in some ways is significant, because the confrontation was Eisenhower's reaction to the question. What Ethel Payne discovered is that when you have a seat at the table, when you're a member of the National Press Corps at the White House, and you ask a question at the press conference, it puts that issue on the national agenda. For instance, in 1954, there was a Lincoln Day celebration in Washington, and the Republicans had a lot to celebrate that year. They had a Republican in the White House who had not, no Republican had been in the White House since the Depression. And at the celebration, they invited three choirs to sing, two of which were white. The third was the Howard University Choir, traditionally or historically black college. The Howard Choir's bus was blocked from getting into the celebration. We don't know the reason, but one can presume it was because they were African Americans. No one covered this story. When she went to the White House press conference, she asked the president, who had been at that celebration, what had happened. He apologized, saying, if this had been occurred, I'm sorry, but we'll look into it. The next day, newspapers like the Washington Post were forced to write a story about this incident because it had been raised at a national press conference. In short, what she discovered is the mere act of asking a question could help put an issue like civil rights on the national agenda. And that questioning came to an end when one day she asked President Eisenhower. She said, the Attorney General says that it lies within your power to end desegregation of bus travel, interstate bus travel. You don't need an act of Congress to do that. Will you support it? And Eisenhower stood up ramrod straight using his military posture and said to her, I don't know where you, emphasizing that you, filled with anger, get off asking this kind of question. We try to do the best for every group, and we're not going to kowtow to any special interest. Well, the hall went quiet, because what he had said was that a large segment of Americans who were denied their constitutionally granted equal rights was the equivalent of a special interest, the same as a farm lobby seeking a favor. And that was embarrassing. It made headlines around the country. It brought the civil rights needs to newspapers all across the country. And Eisenhower learned quickly that he better not call on this woman much longer, because these are the kinds of things that are going to happen.
Now, she went on to have an illustrious career. She traveled around the world. She traveled to Vietnam covering the treatment of black troops there. She also, of course, eventually in 1972 was hired by CBS as their first black female radio and television commentator. How is it that Ethel Payne's name is not better known? I mean, journalists know of her. If you study journalism, you know of her. But she's not a household name in the same way that many white male journalists who reached great heights, or even white women journalists, are.
Her lack of an entry in the history pages of America is just a legacy of our segregation. The historian Mark Bloch famously said that history is written by the light of the victor's campfire. And segregation was so deep, and we've forgotten how deep it is, that this is a legacy. She's iconic to a large group of older African Americans. I mean, I've been on call-in shows around the country where people call in, and you can tell from the timbre of their voice that they're older. And they say, oh, I bought the stamp in 2002.
That's right, she was on a stamp.
Stamp. I remember reading her, you know, those kinds of things. I even found a dean at a college who knew her when she was a child, because she came by her home and thought this was like a rock star coming to her house. But for 85% of America, not only is Ethel Payne unknown, but the whole black press was unknown. They had no contact with it. So as a result, when the civil rights movement succeeded, and when African-American newspapers began to weaken economically, because now mainstream media was paying attention to the issues, and when the best African-American reporters were hired away from those newspapers to go to work for mainstream papers, and that chapter of our press history closed, Ethel Payne disappeared with it. And, some people have had very nice comments about the book, and sometimes the word discovery is used. And I'm really uncomfortable with that, because Ethel Payne was out there. What was wrong is the segregation in our society has kept her hidden from us. I'm not uncovering something. I'm just bringing to light the life of a significant person.
Now, James, you mentioned the way in which earlier on, when she was allowed to enter the halls of Congress in the White House as part of the press corps, because of segregation and racist attitudes, senators would turn their backs on her. But what about fellow journalists? How was she treated by fellow journalists, both male journalists, if there were other African-American male journalists, but also white journalists in general?
In general, white journalists were quite accepting of her. In fact, by her own account, when she began to ask tough questions of the administration, journalists like James Folliard from The Washington Post complimented her and said, these are questions we should have been asking. In a way, the racism of the white press wasn't intentional. The racial struggles were just not part of their lives. They reserved that privileged life of not knowing about these things. I mean, there were plenty of Southern journalists in Washington who objected to her merely because of her skin tone. But she was widely accepted by the white press. And in fact, I can tell a story in a little while about Montgomery. She created alliances with him. Her only source of friction and respect was with another African-American reporter. They were free in the White House press corps at that point. And Louis Latour was a Republican African-American who objected to Ethel Payne and Alice Dunningham's style of asking questions. He was part of that group who felt that African-Americans had to be careful in pushing too much and much more of a reserved approach. And he actually criticized her in public, to which a number of people, including the NAACP, came to her rescue saying, wait a second, these are the kinds of questions that need to be asked. Hmm. But as a whole, the press corps is a very comfortable place for her to be, and that wasn't an issue for her.
Hmm. And so in terms of the history that we are now able to look back on, as you said, you know, as a journalism, leaves behind plenty of documentation for anybody looking to discover Ethel Payne's career. They can if they just know where to look. As a whole, are historians of the past century of U.S. history, the civil rights period and even before that, now reevaluating the black press in writing our history of that time?
I think that's happening. There are a number of reasons it's been unappreciated, but I, for instance, talked with the famous biographer Robert Caro recently, who's working on his fifth volume of LBJ, and he spoke about how important the black press has become to him as a source. One important reason that this is going to change is that a lot of the black press's newspapers are now available electronically going back to their founding. So for a researcher, they can go into an archive and search through these papers in a way that the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times has been accessible to historians. But this is a very significant question you touch upon for a couple of reasons. First, the view that African Americans got of the civil rights movement through the black press was fundamentally different than what whites were getting through the white newspapers. And when the major achievements occurred, like the passage of the 57 Civil Rights Act, granted it was mostly gutted, the 64 Civil Rights Act, which was much stronger, or the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the white press portrayed these as historically important moments, but they portrayed them as munificent gifts being given to African Americans. Whereas Ethel Payne and other reporters were writing, these are the rights that always belong to them that we're fighting to get. It's our achievement to obtain them. This fundamental difference really creates a kind of legacy of misunderstanding about what was going on. And the black press always saw the civil rights movement as a ground-up movement to claim what rightfully belonged to them. And the white press portrayed it very differently. And to this day, I believe there's a legacy. If you look at the polling data between whites and blacks on issues of justice, there's a great separation. And that's in part because I think African Americans still will look at the Los Angeles Times or the New York Times. We think of them as a white person. I think of them as a mainstream media. They recall them as being the white mainstream media, and there's a larger inherent distrust of their kind of viewpoint.
And so that then brings me to this broader question, which is the lessons that we learn about journalism for today. Because as I said earlier, much is made of the sort of objectivity of the journalist on NPR. You know, we have a station in Southern California that says, no rant, no slant, as their slogan. implying that anybody who might be too close to an issue or might actually express some kind of sympathy with an oppressed person is not being objective. What the story of Ethel Payne and the Black Press teaches me is that nobody is objective, that we're all colored by our backgrounds, and so that diversity of income, race, gender is what will keep the press really true and accountable.
Yeah, well, there's no way you can approach a story without your cultural baggage. I mean, you can imagine me as a 60-year-old white man writing about the life of an African-American woman in
yeah.
the 1950s. I had to do a lot of reflection.
Which, by the way, to your credit, you really refer to that, I think, very openly and honestly in your book, and I really appreciate
well, thank
it.
Thank you. I ended up writing a piece for the Daily Beast about it, which was very personal about my upbringing. But the question you ask, I think, is important. Ethel Payne fits in a larger tradition of journalism in which, in many ways, your program and your work does too, which is that the mere power that the press has to shine its light on the darker recesses of society is in many ways its most powerful weapon. Mm-hmm. You could get on the air, and I could get on the air, and use all kinds of adjectives to describe injustices, and listeners have a kind of form of selective perception. They're going to dismiss us based on the comments and the adjectives and adverbs we use, but they can't dismiss incontrovertible evidence. And so, you know, starting with people like Jacob Riis in the 19th century, who brought forward photographs of the deep poverty
right.
in the Lower East Side, to Ethel Payne giving accounts
right.
of what was going on in the South or what was going on in the
yeah.
legislature in Washington, to today, Jonathan Sokol writing about children and poverty.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of journalism, it's clear that the authors, yeah. the people behind them, feel deeply about it. I mean, why else would you give up years of your life to go into rougher circumstances to report on things?
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, James,
no,
but
sorry,
I definitely
but
recommend
you.
Let listeners pick up a copy of your book. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
James McGrath Morris is an author, columnist, and radio host, and we've been discussing his book, Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press.